from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The Cathedral of Cordoba in Spain has been the center of Catholic life in the city since the 13th century. But now the Spanish cathedral has become a battleground in a campaign to reduce the influence of the church in Spain and beyond. Who should own this historical place of worship? To answer that question, religious liberty expert Nina Shea joins us this week on Register Radio. Then we turn to Joan Frawley Desmond, who last week spent some time in Napa Valley, not tasting wines, but rather sampling efforts to strengthen Catholicism in America. Hello, I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host for Register Radio. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Matthew Bunsen, who, in his role as senior Register contributor, penned a commentary on the Cathedral of Cordoba.
That's right. This is one of those great stories, Jeanette, of that nexus of history with modern-day politics and culture. And I'm happy to say that one of my sources for the story is with us today, and that's Nina Shea, director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C., and a frequent source for Register articles on religious liberty, especially the persecuted Christians around the world. Nina, welcome to Register Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be with you both.
Nina, we get to see your words in print so often, but I don't really know how you got started in this work of making known the stories of persecuted Christians, of working to battle attacks of our religious liberty. How did you get started in this work?
Well, Jeanette, I was an international human rights lawyer when I started out my career over 30 years ago, and I started realizing that really no one was focusing at that time on the persecuted church and religious persecution around the world. There were groups that focused on maybe what was going on in Poland or Russia, but there was no one really trying to pull it all together and show patterns and find out more about it other than sort of from a nationalist point of view. So that I was doing my regular human rights work and seeing the importance that church figures played on the front lines of communism and nationalist totalitarianism around the world, and realized that these people were feeling the brunt of the persecution. They were being killed, they were being imprisoned, and no one, China was an example where there, at that time, there was over a dozen Catholic bishops in prison for 20 years in China.
Right.
And no one knew their names, and no one really cared.
And so now you're bringing the names and the faces and the stories to the public, and we're so grateful for the ways you've collaborated with us to do that. Now, we have a story right now. Our online audience seemed to love this story about the cathedral in Cordoba. What makes this cathedral, first of all, so important and so special to so many people?
The cathedral has been a Catholic church cathedral for 800 years, and it is a magnificent place. Before that, it was a mosque during the caliphate there and in the Middle Ages. And before that, it was a Visigoth church, a basilica. So it had been in the possession of Catholics for, over a about a millennium, really. And the Muslim community from Europe is demanding that it be returned to them, and they are joined by or have the support of a left-wing local government who thinks it should be taken away from the Catholic Church.
Now, Matthew, you wrote about this in a story, a commentary titled "The Spanish Cathedral Targeted for Reversing the Conquista." And it's a rather interesting title. Nina referred to the Muslims wanting it back. What's the story? What's the background of this cathedral? Whose is it, really?
Well, as Nina just pointed out, this was originally a church. It was a Christian church that belonged to the Visigoths, who were in Spain before the conquest of the Iberian Peninsula by the Muslim armies. And then they came into possession of the church. They basically seized it and so-called purchased the church, demolished it, and built the incredible mosque that became the Grand Mosque of the Caliphate of Cordoba. Then, when the city fell in 1236 to the forces of the Reconquista, in other words, the Christian armies that gathered together and ousted Moorish control of Spain, the first thing that King Ferdinand III did was to declare this his new cathedral. And Christians have been in control of it ever since. And that's a significant historical ownership.
Now, what is being proposed right now in terms of trying to resolve this sort of conflict that is happening? What do they really want?
Well, I think that the government is somewhat slyly demanding that it be that it's the patrimony of all human people from all epochs, and that it shouldn't be in the possession of the Catholic Church, and that it should be a museum.
You know,
but we know that the Muslims who are demanding its return are not going to be satisfied with that and will continue pressing. And they've already used violence inside the church against policemen who were trying to oust them because they were holding a demonstration. Matthew writes about that. I suspect that there would be more violence again if it were to be held on by the state, and, you know, it would eventually end up as a mosque again. But it should not even be a museum, frankly. It's a Catholic church. It's functioning as a Catholic church. It's always 800 years functioned as a Catholic church. They have mass there. I had the bishop in my office, and Matthew was there and met him as well. So this summer. So it's totally unreasonable. I think for the United States, for an American, it's absolutely shocking.
Right, it is. And it must have been the same visit, because I got to watch the bishop on Raymond Arroyo, The World Over with Raymond Arroyo. He talked to the bishop. It aired, I think it was on June 22nd, a couple months ago. And he tells the story, and he says there's no way that this could become a space where Muslims and Catholics worship side by side. The Muslims would never allow that, and that's just a real Pollyanna-ish kind of
reservation.
Well,
it's very naive.
Yeah.
It's very naive because, according to Islamist theology, is that once a mosque, always a mosque, mm-hmm. and that this is illegitimate for Islamic theological reasons to have Christian worship. So they're certainly not going to share the space.
One of the things that makes this story so compelling but also really disturbing for a lot of people is that there is a kind of alliance now that seems to have been formed between Spanish and European leftists and Islamist groups in Europe. We're just seeing this here, but I know this is happening elsewhere, isn't it?
Yes, and that is happening in Europe now, and it's what is known as the Red-Green Alliance for the sort of left communist red and the green of the Islamist, the political Muslims who want to assert their own control. And it's really, I think, a transparent attempt by the left to repress Christianity and Catholicism. And they're probably hoping to repress Islam, but, because the Muslims are a minority, a small minority there, a growing minority, but still a small one, that they figure that they can, they can control and repress Islam later on.
You know, Nina, not too long ago, our paths crossed, if you will, in the cyber world and the editing that I do, over an editorial that we wrote, the Register wrote, and it was called Rebuilding Nineveh, about aiding our brothers and sisters in Christ who are trying to get back to Iraq. And we wrongly wrote that the Christians were given the option of staying in their homeland if they paid a tax, and that ISIS had offered them this option. This is often called the Jitsa tax. But we were corrected on that, and you were one of the people who brought to our attention that this was just not the case. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and that is another example, I think, of the sort of the secularists, or certainly militant secularists or anti Christian alliance with Muslims, actually, with Islamists, even extremists. I wrote a report on this last summer because it was ISIS propaganda, ISIS, the terror group, that we've almost defeated now in Iraq, our military.
Thanks be to Jesus.
Yes, and they stormed through the province of Nineveh, where most of Iraq's Christians lived at the time, where other minorities lived. It was the most pluralistic place in Iraq, and no non-Sunni Muslims were left after they came through. They were either killed, enslaved, or driven out. And that happened to the Yazidi people, and tomorrow is the third-year anniversary of their offensive, ISIS offensive against the Yazidi homeland in Nineveh. And then on Monday is the anniversary of the beginning of the onslaught by ISIS against the Christians in their major cities and towns in Nineveh, the third-year anniversary. The Christians, ISIS put out the propaganda that it was allowing Christians a choice of paying jizya or this tax. And this is from the medieval caliphate custom of having Christians as people of the book, people of the Bible, to pay a tax instead of, and which gives them the freedom of property, of person, meaning they won't kill them, and of worship, that they could worship. And for 1,300 years, Christianity survived under those terms in this part of the world until the last caliph in the Ottoman Empire in the middle of the 19th century. And ISIS was trying to look like a caliph. It was trying to show to the world and Muslims to gain their approval, to look legitimate, that they were going to allow Christians to live under them. I interviewed the priests who dealt with ISIS from Iraq, and that is completely false. It was fake news. It was propaganda that they put out, ISIS put out. And he said there was no opportunity to pay anything. They thought all the men were going to be slaughtered, and they thought all the women were going to be enslaved. In fact, dozens of women were enslaved and continue to be released and liberated now. And I just heard of a new case of a woman, middle-aged woman, who was taken. I have her picture. It's heartbreaking. She looks like a lovely person. She was she's 40. She was taken and sold to 12 men.
How horrible.
Over 3 years and just serially raped the whole time.
How horrible.
So it was horrible. And she is suicidal now. They're trying to get her to the United States for treatment. And this happened to a lot of the Yazidi women, too, because they did not flee. The Yazidis did gather when ISIS asked the men to gather. And when the men gathered, they slaughtered them all.
Oh, my.
There were about 1,000 men killed then. 1,500, and then 3,000 women taken as slaves, women and children.
Well, it's so important for us to get the story right and to make sure that our audience hears this and knows this.
Thank you for correcting that.
Oh, of course. And of course, it makes total sense, too, that if there were an opportunity to pay a tax, then why would these people be called, you know, why would we call this a genocide? Why would we call this a genocide? Why would the government, the United States government, recognize it last year as a genocide if they had this option? So it makes total sense. It was misinformation. So thank you for that clarity. And of course, we're out of time, but I know you're working on something else, a new book that we should know about and let our audience know about.
Yes, I'm very proud of this. It's I was a contributing author. It's called The Persecution and Genocide of Christians in the Middle East. Angelico Press has just published it, and it's edited by two law professors that I really admire, two Catholic law professors, Ronald Reichlach of University of Mississippi and Jane Adolph of Ave Maria.
Well, excellent. Yes, we've dealt before with Professor Rychek. He's great at what he does. So we're happy to talk about this book
and hopefully
get it in our pages. So Nina, thanks so much for being with us and always being available.
Well, thanks goodness for your existence there too.
That's great. So soon we will have Joan Frawley Desmond on to talk about her experience at the Napa Institute last week in California. This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio on EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More when we return.
Bishop Robert Barron talks about the importance of the National Catholic Register.
You know, the Register delivers something which is extremely important because you won't get it from the mainstream media, namely the Catholic context and perspective. Sometimes the mainstream media will pretend, oh, they don't have a perspective. They're just giving the news neutrally. Well, no one does that. Everyone's got a perspective. What they often bring is a sort of secularist ideology. The National Catholic Register brings a robustly Catholic take on the world, and that's indispensably important.
For a free 6-issue trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. This is Jeanette DiMello, and I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen, as well as Joan Frawley Desmond, of course, our senior editor out in California. And Joan recently went to Napa Valley. And as I said in our intro, it was not to taste wine, but to actually sample some wonderful things going on in our church with Catholic leaders. Joan, you were at the Napa Conference. It happens every year.
Yeah, Jeanette, it's a great opportunity, really. You know, places like Washington, D.C. and New York have a lot of such events and opportunities. But often in California, it can be harder for Catholics in the state or in the West to get together. And what's interesting about this is the Napa Institute, which was started by Tim Bush and a group of other Catholic leaders. Tim is a California-based business leader. He worked on this for some time, and with the help of Archbishop Chaput, Archbishop Gomez, and others, has really launched what has evolved into sort of the go-to place for a lot of Catholic leaders, apostolates, and just very committed Catholics that want to learn more about their faith. It's sort of a high-profile event, and what's great is that people, well, they do actually sample some wine, Jeanette. It is Napa, after all, and it is the summer. But it happens at a very pretty resort. But what's interesting about the whole dynamic is, and because it's summer, is, yes, there's a lot of book learning. There's a lot of time in sort of a ballroom where you have a whole array of really fabulous presentations. But equally important, I think, for a lot of people, people like me and everyone else there, is a chance to sit and share a meal with someone who is really drilled into some aspect, some issue, you know, some aspect of the faith that you're really interested in and are ready to share that with you in a more relaxed way in our busy life, you know. So it also includes women religious from Carmelites and other religious orders are also have their registration underwritten. You're also sharing meals with them. They're singing at the liturgy. The liturgies are beautiful, by the way. So we really have a whole integrated vision in a lot of ways of Catholic life with an emphasis on liturgy. But the headliners this year, you know, were some of the best speakers I've heard.
Well, let me jump in for a second to go back a minute to this mingling of people. I mean, every year we discuss, okay, are we going to go to Napa again? You know, are we going to go to Napa again? Are we going to send Joan or who's going to go? And we always decide to do it because of this chance to mingle with people. And we often get a lot of feedback for the Register, which is very important because we work in our most of us in home offices. I'm in an office, but you guys are in home offices. So it's nice to actually be face-to-face with people and get this feedback. And I had talked to Patrick Riley with the Cardinal Newman Society, and he said so many people came up to him at the Napa conference. He was there as well, and told him that they saw his work in the Register on Land O'Lakes. And, of course, we talked to him a few weeks ago here on the radio show, and he said, people were coming up to him talking about the Land O'Lakes issue, and people who would never have even thought about Land O'Lakes were commenting how important that issue was. So it's great, Joan, that you go to this. It's great that you represent the Register while you're there. Dan Burke, of course, goes as well. And so we appreciate what you bring back, not only the stories, but these connections. It's hugely important. And so you were mentioning some of the headliners, the speakers. Who stands out in your mind?
Well, one theme was inspired by Archbishop Chaput's recent book, Strangers in a Strange Land, Living the Christian Faith in a Christian World, Post-Christian World. Another, and the Register has focused quite a bit on Archbishop Chaput's book, and, you know, as you know, he explores a lot of really important themes at this pivotal moment for American Catholics as they try to understand, with the culture in some ways moving farther away from how they understand they should live their life, you know, how do they move forward? What's the right approach? Do they feel that they need to sort of be part of a more distinctive community, or can they live their faith, you know, in a more diverse, mixed world? So, you know, Chaput explores that in such an interesting way in the book. Another speaker I thought was very compelling and just had a wonderful pastoral presence was Archbishop Gomez, who spoke about how Our Lady of Guadalupe can help inspire our engagement in these difficult times, and how Our Lady's message applies to culture and family and other issues. And what I thought was great, again, was providing this kind of integrated worldview that the faith provides us, as opposed to more of an issue-based approach. And, of course, for Archbishop Gomez, who's been very involved in immigration issues, they commented at the conference, and I think one of his compelling contributions is that he has spoken as a pastor. You know, you don't ever see in him the kind of the raised level of rhetoric, mm-hmm, you know, right, attacking or that kind of thing. And this conference was just a reminder about all the tools that we need to share the faith, and how important at a time when there's so much name calling, that no, what we want to do is bring down that level of rhetoric and really meet it face to face, meet person to person, share the message, keep tweaking how we do it, live the virtues so that we're kind of prepared in each new situation to figure out the best way to share that.
What better way to do it than over table with wine?
Exactly. The food wasn't bad either.
Well, Joan, one of those great ways that the going to a conference like NAPA can lead directly to interesting stories that people may not have heard about is in one of our editorial meetings, you were talking about the Human Coalition. An organization that you encountered there, and now you're going to be writing about it. So what was the story behind this?
Well, it is, NAPA Institute is a great place to collect info on stories, and, you know, there's so much going on out there, we can hardly keep track of it all. The Human Coalition, interestingly, was something I had never heard of before, and yet is one of the fastest growing, in fact, one of the largest pro-life organizations in the country, with a budget totaling almost $10 million, over 100 in staff. And what they do, it was really founded by Brian Fisher, who's a marketing research whiz. And he looked at ways to better connect women seeking abortions, already planning to have an abortion, and going online and trying to figure out where the nearest abortion clinic is, and connecting them with pro-life centers that could offer more options for them. And so he started with this kind of online analysis and improving that whole online connection opportunity between women and the centers. But then he also started to analyze, he and his team, not just Brian, started to analyze the whole process of, you know, connecting, the initial appointment, the kinds of issues and concerns and services that are needed by women who are often facing rather daunting circumstances. And just for one little tidbit I was just really fascinated by, in the process of their research, they have not only increased the outcome of life issues, you know, women choosing life that come into the clinic by almost sevenfold, they have also, you know, produced really interesting insights, like they have realized that you need to look at the environment where the mm-hmm. counseling is taking place and create a softer, you know, more secure, less threatening place, a place where women can really feel calm and peaceful and able to really have a dialogue that can be helpful to her. So that was really interesting. And that insight alone, they said, increased, you know, very strong outcomes by 35%.
You know, Joan, you were telling me about this story that many people at Napa had not even heard of this group. So again, Napa the conference is an opportunity for them to meet other people who can help further their mission.
Yeah, actually, I think what I really come away with at a place like the Napa Institute, and of course at the Register, we're dealing with this every day, is what a really vibrant, exciting world American Catholicism is. Yes, we have a lot of challenges, but the level of entrepreneurship among apostolates and all the new ideas and how they're sharing those ideas and collaborating, and there was a lot of that collaboration on display while I was there. So it's just really fascinating. You know, last year I was there, and Robbie George, you know, who's a leading Catholic public intellectual, was describing a new initiative that he was involved in. And, you know, that allowed me to tee that up and be ready for when they were going to launch it and let the Register be one of the first to write a story. I think we were the first to write a story on a really groundbreaking initiative. So it's that kind of thing that's really exciting. It gets us all out of our silos and gets us talking.
Well, thanks for going, Joan, and thanks for reporting on it. Joan's story on the Human Coalition is titled, "The Human Coalition Learns Secret to Changing Hearts of Abortion-Determined Mothers." For more news and analysis and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.